As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And welcome to Straight Outta Cobham, the Chelsea FC podcast from The Athletic. Each and every week we bring you the best Blues analysis courtesy of The Athletic's Chelsea experts. On this episode we're reflecting on back-to-back defeats at Everton and Wolves. We'll react to a tricky Champions League draw, look ahead to Monday's meeting with West Ham, now minus supporters, and round up the rest of the Blues news. Available for free wherever you get your podcasts and ad-free on The Athletic, this is Straight Outta Cobham, Downer episode. Yes, hello listener, Matt Davis-Adams here. We're coming to you a little later this week, but that's so we can look back on the game at Wolves. Who is we though? Well, Liam Toomey for one. Hi, Liam.
Hello.
Dominic Fifield is with us too. Morning, Dom.
Morning, Matt. How are you doing?
And who could forget the incomparable Simon Johnson?
It's a sombre hello for me to reflect what's happened.
Quite. Well, before we begin, let me remind you that right now, if you subscribe to The Athletic, you can give another subscription as a gift for free. It's the perfect present for any football fan this Christmas. Enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. Wave goodbye to 2020, say hello to 2021 by sharing the gift of The Athletic's unrivaled football coverage for the whole year. It's the perfect present for yourself and someone else. Just go to theathletic.com/ChelseaPod. That's theathletic.com/ChelseaPod and sign up now. Well, Chelsea played twice since last we met. The annual defeat at Goodison Park was followed by arguably the Blues' poorest performance of the season at Molineux on Tuesday. That game freshest in the memory, so we'll focus mainly on it, but we'll look for themes from both of them. Liam, I said that was Chelsea's poorest performance so far this season. Do you agree with that?
Well, I haven't had a full night's sleep, so I can't remember much football that happened before yesterday, but it was certainly right up there. Chelsea offered very little in the first half. I mean, neither did Wolves, to be fair. It felt like a kind of rerun of the Chelsea-Spurs game in terms of the attacking verve being shown by both sides. But Chelsea were just about the better team in the first half. They played most of the game in the Wolves' half and created a couple of chances, most notably that incredible Azuma header. And then in the second half, you know, they did exactly what you would have hoped for Chelsea to do in a game like this, which is to get a breakthrough quite early in the second half. I mean, it was slightly fortunate that Giroud shot creeps through Rui Patricio's hands. But being 1-0 up is, in theory, where you want to be against Wolves because they're a counter-attacking team and now you can give them a taste of their own medicine. And I think that was the main source of Lampard's frustration after the game, was that once Chelsea went ahead, they just didn't manage the situation well enough at all. In terms of the goals they conceded, it felt like a rerun of last season's worst problems. You know, a corner that they don't properly clear and ends up being an equaliser. And then a counter-attack in the last minute where they're going forward trying to win the game, but they overcommit. The entire middle of the team completely disappears. And then it's brilliantly taken by Pedro Neto. I mean, fantastic run and finish. But those are the kinds of goals you can concede if the entire structure of the team sort of disintegrates at a key moment. So you could see Lampard's frustration after the game. He was clearly of the mind that this was a failure of game management on behalf of the players rather than anything he did tactically. I know fans will be divided on that, but it was certainly not a great night and not the response that anyone was looking for after Everton.
Yeah, naivety was the word he used a lot, Simon, in terms of saying that he'd explained to the players that Wolves were a counter-attacking team and that Chelsea needed to try and contain that, and yet they didn't. Liam sort of alluded to it there as to where the blame lies. The manager's got to take some of the culpability for that, hasn't he?
As always, yeah. I mean, any manager after a bad result, questions are going to be asked, and I'm sure Lampard will be asking those questions of himself too, whether he could have done anything different. The sort of use of Werner and Pulisic certainly raised a few eyebrows. The fact that Pulisic was moved after looking quite dangerous on the left flank in the first half, and then spent the whole of the second half out on the right flank, didn't and went very quiet. But I sort of think over the two games, the Everton defeat and the Wolves defeat, you could call it a tie in terms of worst performance. I think people will. It's very easy to just sort of reflect on the Wolves game as the worst because it's the most recent. But I think Chelsea also showed a lot of naivety against Everton as well. You know, they've played that game against Everton many, many times before of being out-muscled and sort of struggling with their physical approach and hitting long balls. And the last thing you want to do against Everton is go behind early because it just plays into their hands. Against Wolves, I just think there was... Weirdly, when they went in front, everything was under control. Then Wolves scored out of nothing, and it was the reaction, albeit the lack of reaction to the equaliser that was alarming. And perhaps even more so was they just fell off a cliff energy-wise. They just looked like... It looked like Wolves were the far fitter team, because up until they scored, Wolves had posed very, very little threat. But there was only one winner in the last 20 minutes. Wolves had all the energy. It looked like the impact off the bench was a lot stronger. You know, for all the outcry over Kai Havertz's performance, Kovacic came on and arguably Chelsea were even worse. So you can't sort of just lay the blame at Kai Havertz. I don't think Kovacic did himself any favours either. All in all, it's a very, let's just say it's a massive reality check, these two performances, in terms of all this title talk that's been going on in recent weeks.
Mm. Dom, Simon's touched on team selection there. Were you as surprised as I was to see Thiago Silva to some extent and Olivier Giroud to a large extent start both these two games, combined age of 70? And in the case of Giroud, I know he got the goal, but Tammy Abraham scored a hat-trick against Wolves last season. I was really expecting him to feature from the off in this.
Yeah, I had anticipated Abraham featuring. It's slightly difficult with Thiago Silva because they look so much better when he plays. And I don't think Chelsea are at a point with their back line yet where they can get by without him in trickier games. And we should acknowledge that, you know, Chelsea going to Everton and going to Wolves, they are two tricky games. I mean, I know they had a fantastic win at Wolves last season, but Wolves in general are a team on the up and a team of some clout these days. And the reality is, as it stands at the moment, and I know there is a load of games that are going to be played on Wednesday night that will change this, but Chelsea have not beaten the team in the top half of the table this season as it stands at the moment. And they've only scored four goals in the six matches they have played against teams in the top half of the table. And I think that's a better reflection of where they're at the moment as a squad and in the development phase they're in. You can put that down to any number of factors, I guess, but I suspect that youth and the sheer number of new signings that Lampard is attempting to get in there, plus the disruption of losing a lot of players in similar positions has contributed to that. But there is your reality check.
Yeah, absolutely. As usual, listener, we ask you for your input via Twitter. Loads of questions came in and the vast majority of them regarding Kai Havertz and Timo Werner and their current lack of form. Shabé asking, how did Chelsea get the best out of the pair? Zaid concerned about Werner's slump. Super Fit Tomato, which I suspect is not a real name, wondering how to get the best out of the pair. Now, because he's got the finger on the pulse, this is exactly what Liam wrote about for Athletic subscribers in the aftermath of Tuesday night. If we take them individually, Liam, Havertz, somebody who you've been championing, we know he's had the issue with COVID, but last night, again, it was kind of stark how poor his performance was, I thought, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think it was maybe his most anonymous of the season. He was completely off the pace. Most of his passes were sideways or backwards. The ones that weren't generally went to Wolves players rather than Chelsea ones. He didn't create a single chance. He didn't have a single shot. So, yeah, it was a really bad night for Havertz, even within the context of a pretty poor collective Chelsea performance. And I thought Timo Werner was very peripheral to the game as well. Wolves did a very good job of keeping him out wide, away from the penalty area, away from dangerous positions. Well, he didn't have a single shot on target. It's the third time in the last four Premier League games that's been the case. And so you're looking at this, and the piece I wrote for The Athletic after the Wolves game was really addressing the fact that in this 4-3-3 system, you know, which Chelsea have looked so good in over the last few weeks and has seemed to have established some sort of identity for this team, Werner and Havertz's best positions, their ideal positions in terms of what they played so far in their careers, don't actually exist. Havertz sees himself as a 10 primarily, although he believes he's flexible enough to play a number of roles. That's where he thinks he's best. And Timo Werner was maximised at RB Leipzig last season in a kind of second striker inside left role, which wasn't quite on the left wing, but it wasn't quite up front either. Chelsea don't play that way. So Werner is having to adapt to playing on the left or in some cases on the right of a front three. And Havertz is having to play as more of a conventional number eight in a midfield three. And a lot of the time against most teams, that won't matter too much because there's just so much talent in this Chelsea team, particularly when the wingers are fit, particularly when Hakim Ziyech is fit. There will still be plenty of opportunities for both of these guys to shine and to express themselves. And it's actually very rare that in a talented squad, you have everyone in their absolutely ideal positions. The key is just that you have a structure that makes sense. But at the moment, 4-3-3 doesn't make a ton of sense when Chelsea don't have a lot of fit, natural wingers. And that's what we saw against Everton, and it's also what we saw against Wolves.
What do you think, Simon? Would you be giving Werner and Havertz a rest? Would you be changing the formation to suit them?
I'd say, look, both of them just look shot of confidence. Like they look destroyed, to be honest, at the moment. Their body language. There was a moment where a cross came in, Werner was at the back post, it reached him and he sort of absolutely, I don't know what he attempted to do, but he sort of shanked it straight out of play and he just looks really sorry for himself. This is a guy that, forget his lack of goals of late, his inability to do the simple things is what alarms me. He sort of passes balls sort of straight to an opponent. It's just like, this is not the player that Chelsea sort of signed. The problem for Lampard is, politically, if Chelsea lose games with Werner and Havertz, two expensive signings, out of the team, then it's not going to go down very well with the powers that be. They spent an awful lot of money on these guys. He's under pressure to get them to deliver. But if they're sitting on the bench and Chelsea lose games, then, you know, questions are going to be asked. So I wouldn't be surprised if these two are just consistently picked regardless, because Lampard can ill afford to be seen to be resting them. He's in a very difficult situation because you have to say both of them, one, they look like they need a rest, but two, they don't actually deserve to be in the team at the moment.
Dom, this is tricky, as Simon said, for Frank Lampard, isn't it? And he's coming in for a bit of criticism, I noticed, from supporters for the first time in a while. You have to say it's kind of deserved, isn't it, in terms of tactics, selection, substitutions. He hasn't really got much right these past two games.
You could argue that, definitely. When the results don't go your way, then the criticism will always come back on him. And I think actually, it's amongst a section of the support, it's always been simmering in the background, that these doubts over Lampard's managerial ability. And I guess that's born of a culture at a club that has been more used to bringing in more experienced managers over the years, and maybe an element of the support that doesn't... I have to be careful with this because it is politically difficult as well. But I mean, I think there's definitely an element of the support out there that doesn't just see Lampard as the club icon that he was as a player, and you know, possibly rightly, are very much assessing him as to, you know, whether he should be there. Does he boast the credentials to be there as a manager? And those questions will flare up whenever Chelsea have poor results. I mean, we've spoken about Lampard's appointment in the past, and it made a perfect sense when it happened, and I think the club are quite right to keep going and pursuing the faith they have in Lampard. I'm sure he will develop into an excellent coach, but he is learning on the hoof at the top of the game, and it's brutal and unforgiving. And you know, away games at Everton and Wolverhampton Wanderers, where plenty of clubs will come unstuck this season, will expose him at times. I think the worrying thing last night was a sort of how passive he was in the last stages of the game. It seemed to be sort of, from viewing him on the touchline anyway, it seems to sort of be, he seemed to be helpless, and that's not a good look. But I don't think he's got necessarily, weirdly, the options to shift things dramatically from the bench. I mean, when you have an overload of injuries in one part of the team that's denied you your natural width, how do you shake things up dramatically on the pitch? Perhaps he should have gone 3-4-2-1 at the beginning. I think Liam makes that point in his piece of this morning. I think there was a logic to that because it does encourage, you know, Chilwell and James to provide you with your width there and a bit more solidity at the back. Perhaps those are the things he's making the wrong decisions over. And they worked well last season. When he shifted to three at the back, invariably, I think Wolves was actually one of the first games he did that away, actually, and he invariably it worked for him. Maybe he needs to be a bit more flexible in terms of his tactical approach leading up to games. But you know, I think it's just an extremes at the moment. He loses a game, you know, that everybody's out to get him. He wins a game, and Chelsea are going to win the league. We probably need to be somewhere in the middle, to be honest. He's a manager that's developing all the time, and this is a team that's developing all the time. I still think they're on the right track, definitely. But, you know, we need these reality checks now and again just to keep us grounded.
It is worth pointing out, and this is no excuse for the two performances, but you look at the league table and Chelsea are 2 points above Manchester City. And it's kind of like before the start of the season, it's the classic, oh, you know, going into Christmas, would you like to be 2 points above Man City? We're recording on the day of the Tottenham Liverpool game, where whatever the result of that game is, Chelsea will be a maximum of 6 points, you know, if one of the teams win, behind top spot. It's not a horrific situation that Chelsea find themselves in. It's a big disappointment, of course, and Chelsea will be under pressure in the games coming up ahead, make no mistake about it. But it's very easy to get sucked into a very negative mindset when actually, if you look at the picture, it's not all as bad as it may seem to be following the final whistle at Wolves.
Well done, Simon. I needed that chirpy bit.
It's a rare bit of positivity for me. Certainly early in the morning when I've not slept.
We're all here for it. So that's the Premier League. On Monday, we learn who Chelsea will face when the Champions League resumes next year. We'll discuss that tricky tie next.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So what's that about winning your group, giving you an easier draw in the last 16 of the Champions League? Doesn't appear to have worked out that way for Chelsea after the Blues were paired with Atletico Madrid in the knockout stages. As a result of Monday's draw, that tie will take place over two legs in February and March. Difficult to preview a tie so far in the future, but we're going to have a go anyway. Liam, what do you think? Was that as difficult as it could have been?
Pretty much, yeah. Not just in terms of the identity of the team in Atletico Madrid and what they've achieved in the Champions League over the last few years, and the caliber of coach that Diego Simeone is, but also the style of team they are. I mean, we've just seen Everton and Wolves, obviously in a low block, you know, kind of take them apart on the counter attack and you know, exploit their mistakes in defence. And Atletico Madrid are essentially the best in the world version of that type of team. So this is a very, very difficult tie. I personally am very much looking forward to seeing Diego Costa back at Stamford Bridge and the madness that will no doubt accompany him. It's going to be a really difficult tie. I actually think it could be the right level of test, though, for this young Chelsea team in the Champions League. They haven't won a knockout stage tie since 2013-14, when they got to the semi-finals and were eliminated by Atletico. They've had a tough run of opponents since then. But while Atletico are a very, very good team, very, very experienced team, they are more beatable than I think the peak Atletico sides that got to the Champions League finals. Or at least they look that way. I mean, they were eliminated by RB Leipzig last year, so it can be done. And if Chelsea produce their best level, then they can get to the quarterfinals. And I think that that's the kind of European seasoning that this group needs. They need big tests, and you can say it's bad luck to get it in the round of 16, and to a certain extent it is, but you do have to play very good teams if you want to get deep in the Champions League. This is the big boy competition.
You feeling optimistic about it, Simon? Liam's right, isn't he? They're not the force that they were.
Top of the league, aren't they?
they're I'm just looking at now.
The
joint top, and they've got two games in hand, so they're doing rubbish.
Yeah, but I mean, Champions League-wise, last few seasons, not been quite
beat
at
Liverpool
the level
last
they were
season.
A few years ago. Oh, all right, look, yeah. Chelsea going out of the Champions League in the last 16, folks, I'm afraid. This is the worst draw they possibly could have got. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Well, if you want some positives, here you go. I'm on a roll here. I'm on a roll. Okay. I know it's a few years ago, but don't forget, last time Chelsea went to Atletico Madrid, they won there. Okay, the team's changed a little bit. There's no Eden Hazard. But that was a team that won with the mighty Timo Bakayoko in midfield. And
that was probably
the
best game for Chelsea, wasn't it, Bakayoko?
He did have a good game. And Batshuayi got a last-minute, you know, another Chelsea legend, Batshuayi with a last-minute win. They've got that sort of positive sort of memory, some of the players that are still there from that game. And look, it's going to be difficult, obviously, but you could argue that sort of reading into where they are in La Liga, is that quite the same accolade as in normal years? Real Madrid, that they've started to rebound a little bit, but Real Madrid and Barcelona aren't the forces they were. So, that's my attempt at being positive. I don't know whether it's worked or not. But Luis Suarez, he's another one Chelsea fans will have fond memories of facing. So Chelsea will want to get the better of him after what happened. Certainly Branislav Ivanovic might be rooting for Chelsea on that day.
Dom, it's a really mouthwatering draw, actually, isn't it? Just looking at some of the ties, it's not as if there was one that you think, oh, well, that would have been far, far easier than Atletico Madrid. All the teams in there are pretty high standard.
Yeah. I mean, and you'd expect that in the Champions League last 16. I'm in jest, really. I mean, I do think that Chelsea will have a good chance of going through against Atletico, but I just think it's almost a tie that of teams at different extremes of their development. You've got a young team that's coming through at Chelsea, and you've got a lot of seasoned streetwise performers at Atletico, but maybe not with the energy in their legs that Chelsea should boast. I mean, look, that's a sweeping generalisation, because João Felix is having a good season at Atletico Madrid, and he's still young. But it is a mouth-watering prospect. I agree with Liam. I can't wait to see Diego Costa. I mean, if he's fit, on form, and selected, then the subplots around his performance in those two legs are going to be absolutely intriguing. I mean, this is a player that Chelsea loved when he was with them, but I imagine will absolutely loathe playing against them again. I mean, it's that in itself will be worth either Simon or Liam just tracking his every move on both those ties.
Not sure I want to get too close.
The other thing to bear in mind, of course, is that these ties are happening in February and March, and we don't know what the state of the teams are going to be in at that stage. They could have strengthened or indeed lost players by the time that the matches actually take place. So on paper, it looks a brilliant time. It is something to look forward to in the new year. Let's see what state the team's in when they go into those matches, the head-to-heads.
Yeah, first leg takes place in Madrid Tuesday, 23rd of February. The return at Stamford Bridge Wednesday, the 17th of March. Before then, Chelsea have a London derby to prepare for. We'll preview the game against West Ham after this.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So Monday night football, sans fans next up in the Premier League for the Blues as Frank Lampard faces his old club West Ham United in Chelsea's final game before Christmas. Simon, they're having a pretty good season by their standards, and we know Chelsea lost this game last year. It could be sticky on Monday.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, West Ham will be looking forward to facing Chelsea for sure. Did the double over them last season and play a similar kind of football that Chelsea have struggled with in the last two games. Full credit to David Moyes. I mean, when he got the job again, let's just say West Ham fans weren't exactly dancing in the street, but he's doing a tremendous job, and they will really, really fancy their chances of piling on the misery for Chelsea. But this is massive for Chelsea. Like, they've got to respond. They've got to get a win going into the other festive fixtures, because yeah, then there will be a lot of increasing talk about Lampard's position, et cetera, inevitably whenever Chelsea go through a bad run, and losing to their London rivals will not go down well at all.
1-1 of 6 against West Ham, Dom. Does that have any kind of bearing on the fixture at all? I mean, there's probably been, what, 3 different managers in that time?
I wouldn't have thought so. Again, the behind closed doors element to it probably makes it a bit alien to those previous encounters, or the most of them anyway. But Chelsea have good reason to be wary. I mean, West Ham used to be they used to be fallible on the road, didn't they? They were a bit of a soft touch, really. You felt you could bully them into submission. But under Moyes of late, they've really steeled themselves away from the London Stadium, and just looking at their recent results on the road, I mean, they win at Leeds, which is a good result. They win at Sheffield United. Everybody does that at the moment. They led at Liverpool and probably unfortunate to lose that game narrowly. Then there was that frenzy of a game at Tottenham where they were absolutely blown away in the first 19-20 minutes, and then end up drawing 3-3 with that tremendous late goal, and go back one game further and they're winning 3-0 at Leicester. So that's a team that actually seems to be thriving away from home, which I suppose isn't that difficult given that the London Stadium is so soulless. It probably doesn't ever feel like a home for any team. But it'll be a real test. It'll be a real test. They'll have to break them down. They've got pace on the counter again. They've got strength. They've got a central midfielder that a few clubs have looked at, and Chelsea being one of them. So it's proper a proper occasion and a real test to see how Lampard can instigate a recovery in this Chelsea team.
Liam, when I spoke to Lampard after Wolves, I asked him about Ziyech and Hudson-Odoi and whether they'd be available for this game. He said possibly. Is there a risk that he might try and rush Ziyech in particular back a bit too soon, given what we've seen in the last few games without him?
I'm not sure about that. I think the general record of Lampard with injuries over his time is that he's tended to be cautious about bringing players back into match action, particularly when it comes to hamstring injuries. I mean, he could have probably tried to play Pulisic against Everton. He didn't, because they know Pulisic's record of injury problems, and they didn't want to take any unnecessary risks. So I can't see him taking any risks with Ziyech and Hudson-Odoi, although clearly, you know, the temptation is there to try and push them back. But the problem is, a hamstring injury, the unique nature of it is you can't really rush it. It's ready when it's ready. And if you try and play someone before it's ready, you will make it worse. So I think Chelsea are going to have to get by with what they've got. I doubt those players will be available, to be honest. They at least can't work on that assumption. And there's no excuse for physical jadedness. You know, they've got the best part of a week to recover and prepare for this game. So first of all, they need to match West Ham's aggression and intensity, which is something they didn't do in the two games last season, and then try and find the quality and the coherence that they've shown in the last few weeks, and hope that players like Werner and Havertz can find a little bit of confidence and rhythm in a system that's functioning a little bit better, whatever that one is that Lampard chooses to go with.
So that game is 8 o'clock on Monday night. It means we'll be recording our final pod of the year on Tuesday next week so we can react to it. We're nearly done for this bumper episode. Still time, though, to round up the rest of the Blues news. Elsewhere in Chelsea news, the women's team won 1-0 at Brighton at the weekend. They struggled against the Seagulls last season, only picked up a point in the away fixture, so that's progress. Speaking of progress, Sam Kerr continued her upturn in form with the only goal of the game. Also, since last we spoke, Emma Hayes' team played the first leg of their round of 32 Champions League tie against Benfica, thrashing them 5-0 away from home. Return leg at King's Meadow tonight as we record, that's Wednesday. I think we can safely assume that they made it through to the round of 16, the draw for which isn't until February and the ties aren't played until March. Chelsea play their final league game of the year against Spurs this weekend. In terms of the men's academy and development sides, under-18s went down 2-1 away to Fulham this past weekend. Chelsea perennial title winners, or at least challengers in the under-18 Premier League South, but currently way down in seventh in the 13-team division. The under-23s, though, plus Petacek, definitely older than 23, they played Spurs on Monday night, came from two down with half an hour to play to win it 3-2. Miles Pert-Harris notching twice, including the winner. Simon and Liam, you both watched this. It was Czech watch, essentially. How did he do?
First half not so good, second half pretty good.
All right, Sven.
Yeah. To try and reinvent that particular phrase. His second touch, his second contribution to the game was to shank a pass straight out of play for a corner. The corner which led to Tottenham's opening goal. And then for the second goal, I think he was less obviously at fault. There was an excellent whipped in cross into the box. He kind of came for it, but kind of didn't. Ended up in the middle, and it was a fantastic header from Dane Scarlett, passed him into the top corner. The funny thing was, Cech didn't really have a ton else to do in the game other than those two moments. But he was certainly not helped by the fact that Chelsea as a team really weren't at it in the first half, and he was pretty commanding in the second as they established themselves in the game. I remember him coming to claim one high ball with an ear-splitting roar of "Keeper!" So he was good in that sense, and I'm sure it must have been a great experience for these young guys to play alongside one of the most decorated and revered goalkeepers of his generation. And he even had to come out and act as peacemaker during the mass brawl that happened in the second half. When Danny Drinkwater responded to Alfie Devine's tackle. I'm sure he didn't envision that as part of his remit for the night. But there he was, pulling players apart and telling people half his age to calm down.
That was pretty incredible, that, really, wasn't it? I mean, we could do a whole podcast on Danny Drinkwater's mentality, I think. But he was on the receiving end to start with that, wasn't he? It wasn't like he instigated it. It was a horrible tackle on him.
Yeah, it was an awful tackle. We have to remember that Alfie Devine is 16, and maybe Danny Drinkwater didn't remember that in the heat of the moment. That's probably the point that many people made to him quite forcefully in the immediate aftermath. But it was the latest in a series of kind of ignominious episodes for Drinkwater in this bizarre sort of second half of his career, really, since he joined Chelsea. But yeah, Cech was a more universally positive influence on the game, and Chelsea mounted a spirited comeback and managed to beat their bitter London rival. So you could tell that it mattered at the end of the game as well. And I think even if Cech couldn't get a clean sheet, the win was the next thing he would have taken from that.
I do wonder whether Cech had a word with everyone at half-time and sort of stressed the importance of not losing to Spurs. I don't think he experienced it on many occasions, certainly in a Chelsea shirt. But I sort of just felt that we saw a difference in the professionalism of two veteran players in Cech and Drinkwater. And Drinkwater, the timing of the incident, yes, it was a bad tackle on him, but not only did he show, you know, sort of get his retribution in, he then squared up to the Spurs players that came in. And I just thought the timing of it was just so idiotic. You know, this is a guy that wants to get a move away in January, obviously. He's trying to attract some interest. And anyone watching that would be thinking, well, why should we take a punt on this guy? Not only is his career, he's barely played any football for the last 2 or 3 years, but unfortunately, he can't seem to sort of get things right on or off the pitch regarding his behaviour. And it was just a very sort of disappointing thing to see. And I'm sure Chelsea felt the same. But on the plus side, you know, it was great to see the Chelsea kids come back. And you know, Livramento bombing down the right flank as he did, and the way that they all celebrated put Harris's late winner all sliding on their knees. I think it just shows how the Chelsea Spurs rivalry is alive and well across all the age ranks at Chelsea Football Club.
Yeah, just as it should be. Dom, not really got your opinion, I don't think, on the Petacek issue. It's a nice novelty that he played in this game, but why is he doing this? I still can't quite get my head around it.
That's you and me both, to be honest. I'm not quite sure how Kepa would feel about it, or even Willy Caballero, to be honest. If it's a matter of getting some game time and just staying as match sharp as he possibly can be, given that there might be an opportunity if there's a sending off or an injury to Mendy, novelty. It's nice to see Petacek back. Don't get me wrong; he was hugely popular amongst supporters and press alike while he was playing at Chelsea. But that era has passed now. I understand that there may be a logic in terms of youth players and possibly if certain people don't want to be picked for the 23s or Lampard doesn't want them involved. I mean, Liam might be better to fill us in on that, but I just wonder how it's the senior keepers at the club feel that there's a chance for some game time here. Look, maybe they sneer at under 23s football. Back in the day, I'm feeling old now, but back in the day when it was at the reserves, when you were put in them, it was almost a slap in the face sometimes. But so maybe that is the overriding impression still. But I just think there's a logic in giving people game time and keeping them fresh.
The explanation I was given when we found out that Cech was going to start this game was that Lucas Bergstrom, the team's regular goalkeeper, had played on Saturday for the under-18s. They didn't want him to play twice in 24 hours. Carlo Ziga, who could have stepped in, is currently in the first team bubble, and they wanted to keep him there because apparently he is regarded as above Cech in the pecking order for senior goalkeeping duties. Now, if you're telling me that if there was a Premier League game next week and they were the only two fit goalkeepers and Lampard needed to win, we'd see what decision he would make in that situation, I guess. But that is very much the message at the moment. Chelsea's kind of approach to this doesn't make a ton of sense, really, because if they want Cech to keep his eye in, so to speak, and keep some level of fitness in case there's first team involvement, well, if you're also saying he's fifth choice, how unlikely is it that he would actually get an opportunity, even in COVID times? It seems very, very unlikely. You're either going to put him in the team by design or you're not. And I've already got one eye on that FA Cup third round tie against Morecambe next month. And I'm very interested to see what happens with that, whether Cech is involved to some degree. And I think if he is involved at some stage, as Dom alluded to, I think there's a real possibility it causes political problems with Kepa and with Caballero, because these guys, you know, signed up to be the primary, well, Kepa signed up to be first choice, but they both signed up to be the primary backup goalkeepers for the first team. And if the technical and performance advisor is playing in front of them, that could be quite problematic.
Yeah, it's very strange. All right, that'll just about do us for this week. Before we go, though, let's hear what the chaps have got on the site for Athletic subscribers to enjoy. Dom, you've got a piece of two halves in terms of maybe how Chelsea supporters will feel while they're reading it. It's the story of Jose Mourinho's second coming. It started well. It didn't end very well.
If people want to start reading it now, they might finish it just after Christmas. a bit about, really about 2015, from maybe taking it on from about April, May time in 2015 when Chelsea, I think we forget how dominant Chelsea were that season. They're winning the Premier League title with three games to spare, with that team with Costa, who we mentioned earlier, and Fabregas doing so well. And then the complete calamity that was the 2015-16 season that ultimately saw Mourinho smuggled out of the training ground in the boot of Silvino Luro's car once he'd been sacked in mid-December, actually, December the 17th, when I think this pod will probably be coming out. So 5 years ago. But yeah, it was quite a fall from grace and lots of different factors involved, and it, hence me writing 10,000 words on it. Apologies to all concerned.
Simon, your piece on Christian Pulisic, pertinent even though he played against Wolves. He's been in and out of late, and it's something that is on Chelsea supporters' minds, whether he can maintain any sort of fitness for a sustained period.
Yeah, I mean, the damning stat is he's started sort of less than 50% of the Chelsea games have been played since he arrived in the summer of 2019, officially joined up the squad then, of course. And yes, it's an ongoing concern. They're doing their utmost to work on his condition. But he sort of, every time he went down against Wolves, sort of there was this. He could sort of just sense that sort of every Chelsea fan around the globe just sort of wincing and sort of hoping that this wasn't going to be another setback. But then he also saw against Wolves, you know, what he can do, like what a difference he makes. You know, the difference with the Everton game where Chelsea didn't have any wide players. Of Pulisic's ilk, and when he was on the pitch against Wolves, it was a totally different threat. So one to really sort of, it is going to be a continuing worry about Pulisic, to sort of how many games he can play, and Chelsea are working on it, but it's an ongoing process, put it that way. And no one's more frustrated, as I say in the piece, than Pulisic himself. You know, that there are sort of suggestions that you sort of read people sort of making out that he's a bit, you know, easy to pull out of games and stuff, where it's not the case. This guy wants to be on the pitch and make an impact. And just quickly, stuff that you can expect to read in the next few days, I'm not sure in what order, but yeah, I've done a big piece on, speaking about Kepa, his situation, along with my other colleague, Adam Crafton, and also, inevitably, ahead of West Ham, a big piece on Declan Rice.
I wouldn't have it any other way. Liam, we mentioned your piece on Timo Werner and Kai Havertz, which I'm sure you were trying to keep the tears off your laptop as you were typing that one. I really enjoyed the bit about Chelsea's golden generation of youth players and how they swept up all the trophies that were available to them too.
Yeah, I really enjoyed putting together that piece and speaking to several of the Academy boys who were part of those great teams in that historic stretch. So that's still up on The Athletic. Go and read that if you get a chance. Go and read the Havertz Werner piece. I've got a piece going up on Petr Cech following on from that game, on that development squad game on Monday. I'm not sure when it will be going up, either towards the end of this week or maybe next week. But give that a read when you see it. I'm off now until Christmas, so don't try to contact me or talk to me about football. But in the meantime, a general message, all at desks. But in the meantime, I can only say go read Dom's big Mourinho palpable discord piece, because it's one of the maddest stories that I've ever covered, and no one writes stories like that better than Dom Fifield. So go and read it; it's really bloody good.
Well said.
Yeah, it was so good it took us all back there.
Sorry,
it's like the stress levels suddenly shut up. And
it was a mad time to cover Chelsea, though, wasn't it? I mean, I know it's a mad club generally for journalists to sort of yeah, to cover on a daily basis. But my time those months at the start of the 2015-16 season were something else.
Yeah, it was quite a time to be working for Chelsea TV as well. I can tell you that.
Lots of positive spin interviews, Matt.
Yes, quite taking chicken poo and make it into chicken salad, as they say.
Lovely.
Listener, remember, right now, if you subscribe to The Athletic, you can give another subscription as a gift for free. It's the perfect present for any football fan this Christmas. Wave goodbye to 2020. Say hello to 2021 by sharing the gift of The Athletic's unrivaled football coverage for the whole year. It's the perfect present for yourself and someone else. Just go to theathletic.com/ChelseaPod. That's theathletic.com/ChelseaPod and sign up now. And thank you so much for your company today. Stay safe. We'll catch up with you again next week. But for now, from Dom, from Simon, from Liam, and producer Adonis, it's goodbye.